All right, hey everyone, welcome. This is the 10th call, Q&A call for SPSM 17, the last official Q&A call, but we will have one more bonus call in a few weeks. Thanks you all for being here. Thank you to my team. Carrie is here helping out in the chat with any questions. Crystal is here helping out as well. Thanks for being here, both of you. Appreciate you, and thank you all for showing up. And all of you who are on the recording. All right, so we will get going. Wide variety of questions. A lot, well, yeah, there seems to be, there's a theme kind of today, which is interesting. There's just lots to do with authenticity. So I'm going to answer all the questions individually, but it's interesting how that was sort of a thread through a lot of the questions today. So, starting with the first one. Hello, Seth. I would like to hear your approach on self-discipline. I was over-disciplined and punished a lot as a child. I now try to be not too hard on myself, but this results often in doing nothing, procrastination, and me feeling very bad about myself. Can you give any advice, especially for the summer months post SBSM that are coming up? Oh yeah, boy, do I relate to this one. So it's pretty much the same exact story here. My father was very much over-controlling, over-disciplining, punishing, all that stuff. I had a very similar adaptation as you describe, where I then basically went into, well, I'm going to do as little as possible. I'm going to be as irresponsible as possible. Or I'm just going to, yeah, do what I want. I'm going to enjoy myself, etc. And these are the normal adaptations that we will make in response to trauma and input that is toxic. It can also go the other way. I just want to make note of that, right? We can have a situation where a person receives no discipline and no responsibilities, or not nearly enough growing up. And so, unfortunately, this was the case largely for my son, because as often happens, I flipped the script and, like, oh, well, that was awful what I experienced. I certainly don't want to pass that on. So, let me do as much as I can to make sure my son never feels any suffering and, is taken care of as much as possible, because I wanted, that's what I thought it must be to be a good dad, because it was the opposite of what I got, which I knew I didn't like. Of course, that's not good either. Kids need responsibility. They need discipline when it's appropriate in a kind, connected way. So that then resulted in sort of, that can result in the opposite. My son later in life is really focusing on ways that he can build things like time management and executive function and showing up on time, just various things that should be simple, but he's had to work on it, which is awesome that he is, and he's doing great. There can be, like, I think of my friend, a colleague of mine, whose daughter was raised in Montessori, and oh, what's the other one that goes along with that? I'm blanking on the name, but yeah, very much a organic, follow your own, student-led, which can be good, but, like, there was very little structure. And her parents also, just in general, were kind of like laissez-faire, oh yeah, just, do what you want. Oh yeah, Waldorf, thank you. Yes, that's it. So it was very unstructured, very loose, and she decided she wanted to join the army after graduating high school, because there is the structure and the discipline. Oh yeah, Rudolf Steiner, that's another one that can be in that tradition. And it's tough, because those can be really great too. Like, the normal school system is not good. And then sometimes, again, we can overcompensate. And so I think we're all looking for a good balance, which is what we want to achieve as adults if we were out of balance in one of these ways. So you asked for my approach on self-discipline, and I can certainly share that. But I also wanted to acknowledge that, there can be other ways that a person may need to go, depending on what they've been through. But for me, and I think really ultimately for everyone, It needs to come from a place about being clear about what we want. That's the first thing, is we have to be clear for ourselves, what is it we want? What goals do we want to achieve for ourselves? And it needs to be self-driven. So not motivated necessarily by, oh, it's the new year. I better get in gear so I can do all these good things for myself. Or as you say, oh, the summer months are coming up post SBSM. I better have discipline. Well, actually, we want to have this self-motivation at all times, no matter what time of year it is or what else is going on. But it starts with know thyself, right? As does so much. So this is about authenticity. This is about what is important to me, what do I want? That's step one. And of course, that can be hard to discover sometimes when we've had been through trauma, when we've been through all these survival adaptations. It can be tough to know ourselves. It can be tough to know what we really want underneath all the ways we've adapted to survive. And that's a lot of what SBSM is about, as you explore your body and your physiology and all these different ways that we offer, you're getting to know yourself. You're getting to know your body, your physiology, which is you. And your impulses, your organic impulses, arise from your physiology, not so much from your personality or your mind or your adaptations. The organic impulses that are really good for you, they are coming from the body. And saying, hey, I need this. So for me, one of the biggest things that I needed was vigorous exercise regularly. That was something I was really lacking, and it was really having an impact on my health. Irene was, she's background in exercise and physical science, so she certainly wasn't going to have it. Me just being a lazy bum, right? That's not cool. So we wouldn't have lasted if I hadn't gotten my stuff in gear. But what was really important is that I couldn't do it for her. I had to recognize that it was something I wanted. And it was, thankfully. I wanted to change. I wanted to improve my physical fitness. So once I got clear on that, yes, this is true for me. I want this. Now what? Well, when you come from a background like you describe in this question, and like I had, it is tricky because it actually, you will probably need to push yourself in a little ways that are, kind, hopefully, gentle. But it means sometimes making yourself do something that your body is saying, I want this, and your mind and your personality is saying, no, I don't want to do that. I just want to do this. For just yesterday, this happened for me. It's still a process where it's like, yep, I know I need to work out. Man, it sure would be nice after that long day just to veg on the couch for a little bit. And I could hear my mind and my personality wanting that, but then I could hear my body saying, oh, but it really would feel good to lift some weights. Okay, I'm going to listen to that and I'm going to disregard the thing that feels more comfortable. And that is one thing that you may consider is you may have habitual patterns of behavior that feel comfortable, that are easy to go to, that may not be that supportive all the time. And so it can involve a bit of good old-fashioned, I'm going to make myself do this. But it's in a way in which you're honoring yourself, not overriding yourself. I hope that makes sense. It's coming from a place of kindness to you. Even though it may feel to another part of you like, no, don't do that. I just want to take it easy, right? So that's why the clarity is so important. You need to be clear on what you want, and then you may need to just make yourself do it occasionally. For me, one way that that was really useful, and of course, this is the context of fitness, but I realized I was really interested in boxing. The martial art. And that was a way, oh, cool. That's a fun, interesting way to start getting fit because I'm interested in that activity, right? So if it's something that you are needing discipline around and you know it's something you need to achieve, how can it be in a way that you can enjoy it as much as possible? And you don't particularly say about anything specific, right? But it's again, it's about this is what I want, and okay, this is maybe a fun way I can achieve it. And then knowing, you know what, I might have to have a little willpower here. I might need to have just a little bit of I'm going to make myself do this, and let's see how that is. So, and again, this can be tricky if you're living with, chronic fatigue, or if you're living with very low capacity. It can be very difficult to push. And maybe you shouldn't sometimes, because of course we've also talked about how we need to stay within our window of tolerance, stay within our capacity. But part of growing that capacity is pushing it a bit. Like you're like nudging the edges. Like, I think I can do this. I'm gonna feel a little tired, but I think I can do this and be okay. And you learn to discover that edge for yourself, wherever that is. Okay. And just to hit it for the other people, if there's a different, like there may be people who have way too much go, way too much self-discipline. Like every day at 6 a.m., I get up and I run, and then I, do this, and then I do that. And it's like a very, you can have a regimented adaptation that is very inflexible. For someone who's adapted in that way, also maybe consider, well, what would it be like to be a little lazy today? What would it be like to let myself not do so much? I can see some people shaking their head. Yeah, that sounds crazy talk, right? Yeah. That can be equally challenging. If we think that we must go, and drive ourselves in order to be worthy, right? This is often how this is planted. We're told by our parents, go, achieve, do. This is how you prove that you are worthy of my affection and my love and my financial support and et cetera, et cetera. There's so many strings that can get attached to performance. Well, in those cases, you may have to consider, you know what? It may be that my body needs a little something less. It may need something else. It may need something a little more gentle. Maybe I don't need to do that 10K run. And I can go for a nice walk instead. Maybe I can moderate the behavior a bit, see how it feels. Again, it's all about challenging what we've inherited and how we've adapted in a way that is in alignment with our authenticity. All right, moving on to the next one. All right. I have problems with processing changes. Also, my parents are stay-at-home persons with early developmental trauma. During your course, I have gained more capacity for changes, but I still respond to them with symptoms, for example, muscle pain when traveling. Could this be a sign of persistent freeze and underlying sympathetic energy in my system? Can you give me some specific advice on how to cope with these unexpected responses, besides just general exercises for reinforcing awareness, which I suppose can dissipate freeze? Question mark. Okay, so having a physical response to change is normal. Even in a regulated system, having novelty, something new coming into our environment or taking ourselves and putting ourselves in an unfamiliar place, it's normal to have some kind of physical response, like maybe you feel a little uncomfortable. Maybe you feel a little nervous. Maybe you're excited. All of these emotions are bodily things, right? Our emotions are physical experiences. We feel them as sensations. We may not be notice that, but that's what's happening. So it's not necessarily a sign of dysregulation, freeze, sympathetic, etc., to have a physical symptom in response to a change. Even if it's something like pain. So, for example, I am someone who would tend to just stay at home if I was just staying in my comfort zone. But I've learned that it actually is good for my growth to travel sometimes, to put myself in situations that are unfamiliar, because it actually does unpack stuff. So even though I'm regulated at this point, and I'm pretty much resolved most of my stuff. If I put myself in a foreign situation, oh, hey, there's a little something. I didn't know that was hiding there. So this happened just like a few months ago. We went to teach in Europe, went to Amsterdam, had a whole piece come through the second night in the hotel. It's like, oh wow, I had no idea that was there. So this is the other thing, is that if you have a physical symptom, like a pain or something pop up in result to a change, well, that's an opportunity. Your body's telling you something. It's saying, hey, listen to me over here. And how can you get curious about that? For me, I couldn't sleep. I just couldn't sleep. My body wouldn't sleep, even though I was tired. So I just sat up and listened and like, oh yeah, I'm feeling some panic. I'm feeling a sense of sympathetic activation. And what would it be like if I just follow that? Well, it meant that my breath wanted to speed up. Okay, let's do that. And I think I sat there for like 20, 30 minutes, just that's what my body wanted to do. There was this big sympathetic charge that wanted to come through in the breath. So you can use those opportunities to listen and follow. Maybe for you, it's like there's a pain and like, oh, this is wanting to do something. If I've tuned in, I got this pain in my shoulder, like, oh, let me just feel that. Let me move around it a little bit. Let me listen. So it's not necessarily a bad thing, and it's actually an opportunity to work with. Now, it may be a sign that you still have dysregulation, and I don't know exactly, what kind of change you're talking about. You reference muscle pain while traveling, but it sounds like it could be any change. And if you have a little change in your life and then you're thrown off for weeks, yeah, that's more likely an indication that, yeah, there's quite a bit of dysregulation still that need to be resolved. Like, oh my God, I had a day that was out of my normal routine, and now my digestion is off for 3 days, or I haven't been able to sleep, et cetera. If it's bigger things like that, then yeah, that's probably an indication. So in terms of how to cope with these unexpected responses, one, understand that it's normal. It's not unusual to have a physical response to change. If you are still living with dysregulation and unresolved trauma, it's doubly so. And how can you view that as an opportunity to work? If it's a pain, if it's a discomfort that's happening in the body, how might you maybe work with creating some space around that, as in the diaphragm lessons, or with the joints, or maybe it's useful to bring in some containment and just connect to yourself. Maybe it's useful to see what it's like to do a couple voos or let out some organic sound, right? Just view it as an opportunity to explore. Because when we have physical symptoms arising in response to stimuli, that's information. And how can we view it like that? Like, oh, here's information. I wonder what this is trying to tell me. Again, the way we respond is so key, rather than, oh my God, what's wrong? I'm having a symptom. I must still be totally dysregulated, right? Which is very critical and self-judging, and it's just going to sort of close the experience down. It's not going to support our well-being, really. And also remember, of course, that you have resources. Hopefully, by now know what your resources are at the least, and you can use those. And it's like, you know what? I just went through this change. I'm feeling the symptom. I just feels beyond my capacity to investigate it with curiosity right now. I can go to my resources and I can soothe myself and I can settle and I can notice what that's like. So, okay. Hello, I have EDT. Recently, my joints need a lot of holding, and there's a new sensation as if they're pulsing and swollen, but they're not. I feel there's more space in my body too, and a lot more cracking going on in all the joints in the neck, chest, and hips. Is that cracking an indication of relaxing in the fascia, the muscles, or the bones? And are all these a sign that stuff is moving and my system is opening up? I feel my rage burning inside me, but there's only so much I can process with CFS, chronic fatigue. When I soothe and come out of the experience instead of going with the activation, I feel like I betray a part of myself, and I also continue feeling the toxicity of the rage that I'm too exhausted to process. The inability to control this makes me even more angry. How to deal with this fire when the body says no. Doing small movements aggravates me more as they don't address the charge that I feel. Thanks. All right. So there's so much richness in this. A lot of really good stuff going on. First, really good awareness that of your own authentic window of tolerance. Like you say, there's only so much I can process because of you're living with chronic fatigue. So it sounds like, yeah, you said you had early developmental trauma. Your system is syndromal with this chronic fatigue representation. So you're aware that you have less capacity. That's really good. That's really good that you can feel what your real capacity is. And I know that it sucks sometimes to stay within that, especially when your body is opening up, and that's what's happening. And this can be a really tricky time. When the system starts opening up and it's starting to unpack what it's been holding, we can be so, like, we just want to get it done, right? We want to process this stuff. We want to, all this stuff is coming. We want to express it. We want to honor it. And we may not have the capacity to do all that yet in terms of our nervous system. This can also be confusing because we may have a great deal of emotional courage, emotional capacity. Like, this can be a case where, yeah, I'm totally willing to express and let this stuff out. No problem. You know, you want to go there, but your nervous system can't actually integrate and process that amount yet. So we can be in a situation where our emotional capacity and our willingness is greater than our ability to integrate. And that sounds like where you're at. And that is a tricky time. So I'm really glad you asked this. It is important to stay within your window of tolerance. When you talk about this feeling like I'm betraying a part of myself, that's where you can have, it's time to build a relationship with that part of yourself. It's an opportunity to really be kind to yourself. So how might you say to that when you feel that sense of betrayal, like, oh, honey, I hear you. I hear you. I will be back. I hear your anger. Okay. I hear how angry you are. Yeah, totally. That makes sense. We just can't process it right now. We have to rest a bit. But please just know I will be back for you and we will do this, right? When we start to be deliberate in communicating with ourselves in that way, it really can work. And it's almost like you're like, rather than you're not ignoring it, you're not suppressing it, but you're just saying, I hear you and we don't quite have the energy to do this right now. I will be back for you later. And then you have to, of course, make sure you do that. And it'll be there. It'll be there. It's not going to go anywhere. So, you know, it just, if you can kindly communicate with yourself in that way, and it's probably a sort of younger aspect of yourself that you're talking to, that's why there's this feeling of betrayal, because that when you were younger, you were probably betrayed by your caregivers, by not getting what you needed, or getting too much of stuff you didn't need, right? So that's one of the keys, is this ability to consciously communicate with ourselves when we are in this kind of situation. In terms of your question about, like, what's going on here, most likely what you're describing is a result of the fascia softening. And like you say, you notice a lot more space, a lot more cracking going on. So, like, when the fascia comes out of bracing, which is part of living in freeze, something that happens very early often, when that fascia starts to come out of bracing, the muscles have more ability to move, which allow the joints to have more flexibility. And yeah, it can be like crack, 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 like all this stuff can start coming out as the joints start to find space and mobility. So that's great. And of course, it makes sense that that would come along with really feeling your rage, because where was that rage packed up? In the musculature, in the joints. That's where it's been hanging out. So now it is freer in the system, and all of this is good. It's just, can you really be kind with yourself and only do what you can really do? It'll happen. It'll all be there. Because the more you do that, the more you stay within your capacity and you do the work the best you can, the more capacity you will get. It's kind of slow, and that can be frustrating, but it's real. It's not big, fancy catharsis necessarily, but it's integratable. It's change that can actually last and build on itself. The final point I'll make is that it is possible to mobilize rage without doing a lot of big activity. So you can use your breath as a way to sort of, you can use sound, you can use your face. You can use your eyes. You can let your eyes just really get intense and send energy with sound and your face. So I can demonstrate that. This is a question that we often get is, do we want to demonstrate stuff? Well, it can be tricky because, again, maybe someone doesn't have the capacity to do this. It's also a lot of people would never consider that they can move their face or their eyes in these ways. So I will do a little healthy aggression, annihilation, energy demonstration just using my face and my eyes and my breath. Please know I'm not mad at any of you. Okay. This is just for demonstration. All right. So. That's pretty powerful. I'm just using my face and my breath and my eyes and my teeth. But whew, there's some heat. There's some energy coming through. So you can do a lot with a little. So consider that if you're feeling really tired. It doesn't have to be hitting, pushing, snarling. It can just be whoosh, let it come through. And again, that may be hard for some people. Like it may be hard to raise your lip, or maybe hard to narrow your eyes, or let your eyes bug out and look crazy and psychotic like that. It does stuff. It moves energy, and it can be hard to give ourselves permission, but I give you permission to play with that. Okay, next question. I've struggled with sleep for a long while, and I realize that I feel a lot of fear come up as it becomes evening. Fear of vulnerability, aloneness, and the dark. I know night times felt very unsafe for me as a child. I've been doing exercise in the evening to try and know that I am safer, but the fear hasn't changed. So I wondered if you have any direction on this. I think that I fear going to sleep because it will mean not being able to protect myself from threat. So I need to be on all the time. Yeah, really common experience. This is hypervigilance, right? I have to stay on, I have to stay protected, I have to stay aware of my surroundings, or the bad thing is going to get me. Not uncommon at all in childhood. And then if we've been through a lot of trauma and we weren't responded to well, etc., yes, this absolutely can persist into adulthood. So, a couple ideas. There's a few different ways you can work with this. One is to explore using resources at night when you're going to sleep. So it sounds like you're already doing practices to help you know that you're safer. That's great. Keep that up. What would it be like to have some light on while you're going to sleep? Like just a couple candles, like that are safe, like little tea lights that are in a glass thing so that they won't start a fire. Have a couple little flickering gentle candles somewhere so that you have a little bit of light. Or maybe a nice, like a Himalayan salt lamp or something like that. That's a nice soft glow that maybe you can fall asleep with the light on. That could be one way to start bringing a little bit more safety into this nighttime experience. And then maybe after you do that for a while, if it helps, right? If it helps your system, then okay, you can do that for a while and then see what happens if you only have one candle or. Maybe you then, just as you're falling asleep, you maybe play with turning off the light. And then, oh, nope, my system spikes up. Okay, I'll bring the light back. So, using resources. Some people like things like having some kind of soothing music to play while they're falling asleep. Some people like the sound of a voice talking. There's the the whole wild and wacky world of ASMR out there on YouTube, where there's, people just talking and making sounds and stuff. And there's whole channels devoted to this, of people talking quietly or like making random sounds and stuff that produce these triggers for people. I used to use ASMR myself all the time. It was really helpful for me to go to sleep. I particularly like this one old Irish man. It was just a sound, this old Irish guy talking about how he did these chores around the house. And like, oh my gosh, it was so soothing. And the sound of that voice, and I would just go right to sleep. Nothing wrong with using stuff like that. Whatever may be helpful for you to feel a sense of like, I'm not alone. There's some presence here, whether it be a voice or music or a light. So you could explore that as one possible route. Yes, ASMR. So it stands for Autonomic Sensory Meridian Response, I believe. And this is something that a lot of people have, where you get all these sort of tingly, pleasant sensations in the head and the neck and the shoulders sometimes, the back, that result from certain triggers. For some people, it's a soft voice. It could be the sound of pages turning, the sound of drawing or painting, moving paper. There's all sorts of stuff. Yeah, Irene's voice. A lot of people have used just Irene, the neurosensory exercise. Put on a neurosensory exercise, the kidney adrenal lesson, right, as you're going to sleep. That's a great idea. There's so many ways. Yeah, thank you. There it is. Thanks, Crystal. That's a whole world on YouTube. It's weird. Go check it out. We live in a strange time. But there's all sorts of things out there. So consider your resources. Now, also, how might you explore elements of going to sleep when it's not that time? So what would it be like to just sit in a dark room when it's daylight and you're not sleepy? Do you still get the same response? Is it maybe a little milder, or maybe an echo of the response, or maybe it doesn't happen, but it could be an interesting thing to explore. Ultimately, what needs to happen, of course, is the big sympathetic charge that's in your system, keeping you awake and telling you danger, danger, that needs to be released, right? That's ultimately what needs to happen. Again, that's the goal. That's the holy grail of nervous system work, is when we have the capacity to let that happen, because it takes time. In order for these things to be released, they have to reach their peak of intensity. That's how they turn off. So that means feeling the most panicked and afraid you've ever felt in your life without being scared of that experience. And that's how these things resolve. And that takes time to learn how to do. That's why we need to build our capacity. It's like, and it may sound crazy, but it really does work. That is, it's like the charge has been trying to do its thing. Okay, finally gets to do its thing. And then, oh, whew, done. So that means probably mobilizing the energy at some point. So you could start exploring that. And it may be that you start that like in the scenario I described, like you make a dark room, but it's daytime, you're not sleepy, you just sit there, notice, is there any sense of that fear? If so, what might it be like to start mobilizing that energy? So if it's fear, that's the flight response. That means we want to run. That means we want to get away. So what if you just let the heels start to lift a little bit, as if you're kind of running a little bit, but just with the heels? Can you feel that connect to the energy? And this is the key with mobilization. It's not about going through the motions, like just let yourself run. You need to be connected to the charge, right? So first, you need to be in a situation where you can feel some of that survival stress. And then you need to explore letting it start to move and be mobilized in some way. And ideally, in the service of titration, again, this can happen when it's not so intense, when it's not actually nighttime, when you're not actually fully terrified. Because trying to mobilize from that place at first may be too difficult and may send you into, beyond your capacity. But it is an option. Once you start to feel like you have capacity on board, once you've maybe played with this in a titrated way in these kind of environments that you create, eventually, then yeah, that it may mean literally like I'm in bed, I'm trying to go to sleep, here's this feeling of terror. Ah, I'm gonna sit up. I'm gonna turn on my light. I'm gonna sit on the edge of my bed. I'm gonna let my legs start to run. I'm gonna go. Oh, I can really feel it. Now my legs are really going, and I'm going, and I'm running. And you just go until there's no more energy left. And then, oh, wow, I don't feel nervous anymore. This is literally how SE was discovered. If you read Waking the Tiger, this is how this work was discovered, was a woman who had anxiety. And Peter Levine was working with her because the psychologist didn't know what to do with her. And on a whim, he said, "Nancy, there's a tiger behind you, run." And she just started running in her chair. And she ran and she ran and she ran for I think it was like 15, 20 minutes. It was a decent amount of time. And then her anxiety was gone, like for good. And that's a pretty straightforward case. He got lucky. He got real lucky. But that is what helped him discover these principles. Like, oh, these are survival charges stuck in our system, and they want to do something. They're trying to do something. They're trying to get us safe still. So that's all a bunch of stuff to consider there. Hello, team. I've become aware of deep-rooted resentment towards society, a sense of disappointment and betrayal. That sounds pretty heavy. For context, I'm aware of birth trauma and trauma related to school. How can we work with these feelings? I'm aware that they are a roadblock on the path to recovery. It's almost like a sense of entitlement to an apology, which I know sounds quite ridiculous. Okay, well, that doesn't sound ridiculous to me. I think that there's quite a bit that society has to apologize for. It's not really any one person's fault, which is makes it tricky, right? But yeah, the world we grew up in and are still living in is run on survival mode. And it asks all sorts of things of us that are an insult to our authentic nature and just our beingness as mammals and a creative individuals and free thinkers, and there's so much that gets put on us through society that is toxic. So it doesn't sound ridiculous at all to me. This sounds like it makes complete sense that you would have a resentment towards society and like a sense of disappointment, and you want an apology. Like, yeah, I get it. You're not going to get an apology, I don't think. So yeah, you may need to let go of that, but the feelings themselves are not a roadblock on the path to recovery. They're part of the path to recovery. Those feelings of resentment and anger, that is juice, that is fuel that you can use to, yeah, like I was just talking about, mobilize, right? So this is where healthy aggression and annihilation work come in. You need to let yourself destroy society within yourself, please. To go and try doing this for real. But within the venue of your own imagination, yeah, have at her. Blow up the freaking United States or wherever you live. Blow up the earth. Stomp on the White House. Crush your school. Breathe fire on the dollar bill. Whatever it may be. Like, whatever it is you're pissed at, you find a symbol. Find a symbol that represents society for you, that represents maybe it's your school since you mentioned that. But in order to mobilize aggression and anger, which is really what you're talking about here, we need some kind of symbol to work with, in terms of at least this idea of the annihilation work of destroying something that has hurt us. So, yeah, how might you find that? How might you find a symbol to work with and go into that work? Now, of course, again, I have to always add the caveat, this is dependent on your capacity. Not everyone is ready for healthy aggression and annihilation work. It's really high energy work. But you can explore it again in titrated ways. It doesn't have to be huge and cathartic. You can start with just visualization. Eventually, of course, read the articles, read the practices that are on the site. But you can start simply. You can start just imagining things, see how that feels. When you feel that sense of resentment and anger, okay, how can I start to see that? Is there a color to that? Is there some way that my body, if I really feel that, does my body want to do something? Does it want to hit? Does it want to twist? Does it want to claw? Does it want to push? Does it want to kick? Does it want to stomp? What is some way that I can mobilize that energy? Just checking my notes here. Yeah, I think that's pretty much it. It's just about allowing that, because you're talking about resentment and disappointment and betrayal. Really, that's anger. I mean, if you look at the primal root of that, that's anger and then probably grief as well. So the old anger, grief, onion. So yeah, give yourself permission to start working with that in the spirit of healthy aggression. Yep, and a question in the chat. Yeah, anytime I'm talking about mobilization, it has to be within our relationship to our window of tolerance, right? That's why, again, so much of this work is going back to the start, know thyself. What is your capacity? What is your genuine capacity when you're not using survival energy to override? That's so much, that's like sometimes that's the whole first year for people, is just through experimentation, figuring out, oh, this is my real capacity. Wow, that sure is a lot less than I thought it was. Okay, now I have to work from there. And that's pretty much always the case because survival energy lets us do all sorts of stuff that we may not otherwise be able to do, right? So figure that out. Figure out your capacity. And that's how we know how to relate to all of these practices because we start to learn to feel when we're going out of that window of tolerance. And some of those signals may be thoughts. We may not feel present. We may start to feel dissociated. We may get irritated. We may get angry. We may get really sad. We may feel checked out. We may, you know, there's so many ways. We may start to feel tension somewhere in our body. We need to learn our own signals that tell us, ah, okay, yep, this is me no longer within my capacity. So now I need to stop. And then what happens is you learn to catch that. You learn to realize this is at my edge. Cool. This is where I want to be. I want to be at my edge. I'm not going to do any more. I'm just going to stay here for a bit and then I'm going to back off. Okay. I'd appreciate your thoughts on enmeshment trauma. Why does it come up and how would nervous system work entangle it? I realized this year being with my mother that after 10 days, I kind of gave myself up and it felt like I had no other choice. I also, therefore, from my teens on, tried to get away from friends as I felt like the same probably around my teenage friends. I just noticed it and it normally comes if I spend a prolonged time with some, but maybe not all people. So what you're talking about here is attachment wounding and enmeshment is a symptom, a result of attachment wounds, dysfunctional attachment patterns, etc. Enmeshment essentially is I don't know who I am anymore. I'm merged with this person and their needs are my needs now, and I'm taking care of them to take care of myself, and all these things that can happen and get formed early on. The way it happens is when we are not attuned to and responded to appropriately and accurately from the get-go, and when our authenticity is not supported. And this is a really common way that this happens is through parents trying to live through their children, trying to, projecting all the stuff that they didn't do onto their kids and thinking, you need to do this. This all usually happens unconsciously, of course. Yeah, just not even being seen accurately, not being attuned to appropriately. All of this can lead to a young developing system essentially starting to try to figure out, who do I need to be for this person to pay attention to me? Or who do I need to be for this person to treat me nicely, to not scream at me and hit me? Who do I need to be to get my food? Who do I need to be to get that school outfit, etc.? This again, this is about authenticity. This is when we lose our authenticity. It's so easy to just adapt and mesh and chameleon ourselves into whoever this person needs us to be. So, again, building relationship with yourself to discover your authenticity is what you need to do as an adult. A big part of that may mean boundaries for a time, because especially with family members, especially with your mother, it's like you could not ask for a more powerful trigger to put you back into your childhood state than your mother, because guess what? You were literally one at one point. So that trigger, is strong. And many mothers never learn or figure out that they need to actually like let their kids go and start relating to them as an individual and an adult. So that can place a lot of strain on a system that is still dysregulated and trying to resolve this stuff. So it may mean that while you're figuring out your authenticity and how to maintain that, you have to have a boundary in place with how much time you spend with your mom or with friends, etc., where you feel like you just lose yourself. Because it may be too hard to try to do that in that context. I also completely relate to this one. That was one of my adaptations, was who do I need to be? Who do I need to be for you to like me? Who do I need to be for you to not yell at me, right? And man, that's a really hard way to live. The classic story of when I first moved to Whistler and Irene had an SE presentation that she brought one of our teachers to the house in Whistler to talk about SE to about 20 or 30 neighbors. I had just moved there. People started coming up the stairs. By the time like the fourth or fifth person was there and I had introduced myself, I had to get the hell out of there. It's like, oh my God, there's like 20 more people coming. I'm already overwhelmed with trying to be like five different people for these five different people. Like, oh my gosh. And I just fled, totally fled the house. It's just exhausting. So, learning to maintain our authenticity, no matter who we're with, it takes time. It's rooted in all the things we've been talking about. Learning to know yourself, your capacity, what's genuine for you, who are you outside of your adaptations that you've made, and all that wisdom is in your biology. It is in your body. It's in the signals that are coming from the tissues. So that is what this work is all about. All right. When I'm out in public, I struggle to be present, and using the tools doesn't work. My nervous system reacts as if everyone around me is watching and judging me. My attention is constantly focused on how I look, how others perceive me. It feels like I have to appear and behave perfectly, especially around men. I can sense a lot of shame in this. I was bullied for my looks as a child. So, a very similar thing here in terms of I can't just be myself. There is all sorts of fear of judgment. I think that everyone is always watching me and criticizing me. So there's some similarities with the last question. But what's interesting is this one, I think part of the solution for this is actually about discovering what's not you, right? Because in this question, it's basically all about you, right? This is How do I keep me safe? Everyone's always watching me. I have to be perfect. How do I look, right? All this is totally normal and understandable. This is just another normal adaptation to not being accepted, to being traumatized, to being bullied, right? It's not your fault. But it means that you're very oriented to yourself. You're very oriented to your experience within yourself. So, how can you start to connect to what's outside you instead of being so much in here? Because all of this is happening in your head. And there's feelings, I'm sure, as well. Like you say, you sense a lot of shame, and that's a visceral feeling. But a part of the solution for this might be to start really learning to pay attention to what is not me, which means what is out here. So that may mean, oh my gosh, I'm starting to realize people looking at me. How am I walking right? How do I look? Is my hair okay? Am I, wait, stop. Oh, there's a bird over there. Okay. Oh, there's a car, and there's a tree. Yep. There's all sorts of other things out here. Right? It's learning to bring your that skill of orientation online. So I hear you say here, I struggle to be present, and using the tools doesn't work. Well, I'm not sure which tools you're trying to use. But they will work. It just may require a lot of practice. And you don't need to be too fancy. External exploratory orienting is really the main one that you need here to start, so that you can start to be less in your head and more in the environment to what's really happening around you. Because chances are people are not paying attention to you. People are self-involved. People are worried about their own stuff. People are worried about what people are thinking about them. Right, so chances are you're really not being criticized and scrutinized, and you can start to really check out your environment and notice that. Now, it may be useful to do this at first where there are not a lot of people, just to practice the skill of paying attention to stuff outside of you. So, nature, parks, place where there's a fair amount of expanse, where there aren't tons of people. Practice, practice, practice your external orienting. Really build that muscle of being able to pay attention to what's out here instead of in here. Then you might be able to start taking that into situations that are a little bit more crowded. And again, like maybe you pick a park or a mall, someplace where there's lots of people just going about their day, doing their thing, and really orient to that. Look at them. See that they're not paying attention to you. I mean, it may be that someone will glance at you or look at you. I mean, don't stare at people because then they will look at you. But just pick a spot, pick a bench, just sit there. Look around. See people just going about their day. On. Eventually, this will probably make it possible for you to have more access to like the shame, the deep stuff that's in there. And that is, of course, really, really important to process as well, this sense of shame. And I'll refer you to the video on that just to refresh. It's about disgust, because when we've taken in toxic shame, often the doorway to resolving that is by allowing disgust to express. The link to that is it feels disgusting to have those imprints put on us, to be bullied, to be judged, to be told we're not good enough, to be told you need to wear this or you need to look this way or you're not worthy. All of these shaming behaviors and language that get sent at us, for our system, that feels gross. It's like, ugh, I don't want that. Blech. And so that affect, that sound, that motion, that sort of heaving up from the gut, which is where that shame often lives. Ugh. Like, oh God, I don't want to hold that anymore. Blah, ah, right? Let it out. So check out that video on YouTube. I think it's called Disgust, the Gateway for Healing Toxic Shame. Crystal, if you can pop that in the chat, that would be awesome. Oh, there it is. Awesome. Already there. So yeah, have a review of that. That might be in your future as well. But for now, I really think it's about building the ability to notice the outside instead of the inside for a while when you're out in public, and start where that's easier. Really build that skill for orientation. And then when you start to feel like you can do that better, the next step is to see if you can be more connected to the body and less to the thoughts. Right? So, of course, a lot of this is, oh my gosh, are they looking at me? Do I look all right? Am I okay? I need to check the mirror. I need to look at the window. Again, totally relate. No judgment here, man. Like, I have done that a lot in my life. Is my belly sticking out? Am I looking too fat? Oh my God. Right? So much of that. So when you learn to start doing that less and paying attention and being present, you may be able to start to feel the sensations more instead of the thoughts. And that's what you want to start to tune into, is the felt sense instead of the paranoid thoughts and that kind of stuff. All right, I got about 5 questions left. Let's take a little pause. It's 3:56, so we will resume right around 4 o'clock. And feel free to get some tea or water, go to the bathroom, stretch, whatever you need to do. We'll be back in a few. Alrighty, welcome back. Hi Seth, I would like to understand why I can only start something freely once I'm certain that I'm healthy, like a new job project or something similar. And why do I always need to know that there's an escape route when it comes to commitments? Even with fun commitments, I need to know when I can leave again. Thank you. So this is an interesting question because depending on the level of voltage, I'll say, around this stuff, this could just be normal. Like this could have nothing to do with trauma. It could be like, well, yeah, I don't want to start something new until I feel healthy. Like that's a basic Maslow's hierarchy of needs thing, right? Like need your water and your food and your shelter, and you need your family and your connection, and now I have room for creativity. Like it's there's It could just make sense, right? It could, and also like, well, yeah, of course we want to know we can get out of something, right? I don't necessarily want to go into a new commitment without knowing that there's like a way out of it if it doesn't feel good, right? So that could just be, healthy awareness. However, since you're here doing this work, my hunch is that this probably feels there's probably a bit more urgency to these experiences, a bit that they're maybe a bit survivally in terms of how they feel. Like, I really got to make sure there's an escape route. Like, and boy, I got to feel just right before I begin that thing. So that's sort of how I'm interpreting this, is that it probably feels quite urgent. So it sounds to me like there is essentially a couple things going on. In terms of the first one, is there a feeling like you need to be perfect or that you need to feel ready in order to begin something new? Like you can't just start something new from where you're at, wherever that may be, messy or not, right? I mean, again, I don't think anyone wants to start something new if they're not feeling well. So that's normal. But maybe you mean like, oh, I can't start anything new until I'm totally regulated in my nervous system. It's like, well, what if the new thing is something you need to help regulate your nervous system? Like a new, more activity that you need to start doing, or more social connection in some way, or like, what if you need to do a new creative project to really develop your authenticity and bolster that? And that's part of your healing. So I guess that's one thing you could consider is how can you start something from where you're at, no matter where that is, and let your guiding light just be your genuine capacity, whatever it is. And know that maybe you can allow whatever is real for you to be part of that experience. And maybe it's not perfect. And maybe it doesn't last. Who knows? But it sounds like there maybe is a hint of perfectionism or feeling like I have to be ready or something like that. Because there maybe is a sense that it's not okay just to be where you're at, is my hunch. And in terms of needing the escape route, even with fun commitments, again, completely relate. Like, yeah, if I could just be alone at home, like all the time, all right, safe zone. Thankfully, I no longer really feel that way. I genuinely like to go out and do things and have new experiences and explore my edges and, do all these things that I used to avoid at all costs, but totally get it. I think that, it's possible there's just some flight energy in your system here. There's a need to flee, or a need to be sure you can flee, right? So, yeah, what might it be like to explore that directly in the ways we've been talking about through mobilization? Maybe if you find yourself considering an opportunity and you already are looking for the escape route, well, maybe take a moment and really like imagine like doing that. I'm going to escape. And yeah, mobilize the energy. What does it want to do? If you really see yourself running to get out and you're free and you're successfully escaping, then great. All right. See what that's like. Yeah, it sounds like, again, this may relate back to authenticity. Like, how can it be okay just to be where I'm at and who I am, and that I can start something and agree to something from that place, knowing that from moment to moment, I can use my tools and my awareness to see where I'm at and evaluate. And you're like, you know what? I'm starting to feel a little overwhelmed. I need to take a break. Awesome. That is generally a more regulated approach than trying to strategize our way ahead of time out of something. Question: what does a healthy slash authentic relationship feel or look like? And how can this work help me finally decide whether I'm with the right person? We've been together 10 plus years and have no kids, or whether it's time to leave. He's a wonderful person with lots of freeze. We have lots of love, but lack a deeper connection. It's good, but something has felt off for a long time. He started SE therapy a few weeks ago. Advice? So, I mean, I'm not a relationships counselor or coach. It may be that this is something that you want to bring. If it's really something you're considering, do I want to be together with this person or do I not? Well, the first thing I'll say, in an authentic and healthy relationship, you can talk about that with the person. You can say, yeah, you can talk about the fact that you're not sure if this is still working for you. And so if you feel like there's no way you can even bring that up, that's a bit of a sign that maybe it's not. Now, that doesn't mean that it can't become that way. And again, this is the role of a counselor, really, like a relationships therapist, a relationships counselor, someone who works with couples. If you can find a trauma-informed somatic one, amazing. They're rare birds. But sometimes even just a regular couples therapist can help get some clarity on these things because they know how to hold space for a couple, and ask the right questions generally. So that's one thing to consider. But in terms of what a healthy, authentic relationship looks like and feels like, well, it's about safety and authenticity. Do you feel safe to be yourself? And I mean all of yourself, all the messy bits included, including the parts that doubt, that fear, that worry. Can you express your fears? Can you express your worries? Can you express if you have a problem with what they're doing? Irene and I wouldn't have gotten very far if I got like totally upset every time she criticized or noticed that I was doing something that was like not the healthiest or based in a trauma response, right? So we need to be able to call each other out on our behavior. We need to be able to communicate that. It needs to be an interest in that. There needs to be a shared interest in knowing each other at a really deep level. It can be really important to have shared interests at a core level. And I mean at a core level. So, like, not so much, oh, I like jazz and he likes rock and I like this food and he likes that. But, like, what are you doing here on planet Earth? What are you about? Is there a shared goal? Is there a shared mission, so to speak? Is there a shared core set of values where it's like, yeah, we're both. Yeah, we like all sorts of different things, but we both really care about, being of service, and we want to help heal ourselves, and we care about the health of the planet. Like, is there a shared core value system? Are you interested in each other? Do you like each other? Right? You can love someone and not like them very much, which is weird, but that happens. So you need to ask yourself that question: Do I like this person still? All this again might be best explored with a couple's counselor or therapist. Can you really be intimate with each other? A healthy relationship means true intimacy, which means like, yeah, like, do you hide your bodily functions? Do you not pass gas in front of your partner? Guess what? That's not a very close relationship. You need to be able to be a human with all your burps and farts and sounds and all that stuff. Do you close the door in paranoia if you have to go to the bathroom? I wrote an article about this, which I'll pop in the chat, which was in response to Irene and I were listening to. We were on a road trip, and listening to a Bill Maher episode. And what he was talking about relationships, I was like, oh boy, Bill. Oh boy. So I'll put that in the chat. That's an article about intimacy and trauma. So yeah, those are all the hallmarks. Like, can we be truly close in all our messiness? Is there room for us to be weird, to be playful, to have our emotions, to be, is there support, right? That's great that he just started doing SE sessions. What I would want to know is why. Is it because you really wanted him to? Or is it because he really was like, oh man, yeah, there's something to this. Like, I see the work that you're doing and I see the change in you, and I want some of that for myself. This is inspiring. I want to do this. Because that's a whole different ball of wax versus, oh, I better do this or she might leave me. Right? So motivation is really important. So all of those are things to consider. Okay. I just did Ilya's sounds lesson, sat outside feeling connected, and then an overweight young man passed me and smiled while he grasped his towel on the way to the pool, and I could feel his shame. I was feeling self-love at a deep level by contrast. Could you talk about genuine self-love and self-respect and how we grow more of it? It helps us and it helps the world. So just very simply, again, authenticity. Authenticity is self-love, is self-respect. If we know who we are and we honor who we are and we express who we are and we have access to our real feelings, that's self-love. That's self-care. Part of that, it's part of real self-love and self-respect, usually involves boundaries. Especially if we're coming from a place of dysregulation and trauma, where we may have all sorts of attachments, all sorts of relationships that actually don't support that self-love and that authenticity. And as we move into that and we start to grow and we start to know ourselves more and who we are authentically, we may start to realize, you know what? That person really doesn't actually support me or want to be with me how I am. This was a trauma bond. And this is what happens when we form relationships and we're still traumatized. So we tend to form relationships with people that replay certain patterns in our lives, and we are doing the same for them. You be my mom and I'll be your dad, and we'll bounce this dysregulated patterns back and forth with each other, and maybe we can find a different outcome. But unfortunately, these things are usually unconscious, and it's just a rehash and a replay over and over again with different relationships. So as we develop our authenticity and our self-care, our self-respect, boundaries may be part of really cultivating and watering that. And another piece may be self-forgiveness. Because you know what? Some of us didn't behave the best all the time. As we were going through life with our trauma and our pain and our suffering, we may have acted out in ways that hurt others. So part of really growing our self-respect may be owning that, apologizing, or at least owning for ourselves, you know what? Yep, I didn't do that well. Okay, that's okay. I love myself and I can do better next time because now I know myself. I didn't know myself then. I didn't know what I was doing. I can see how I was acting out and replaying this pattern. I can see how I was acting out of survival. Wow. Oh, poor little guy. It's okay. You don't need to do that anymore. It's okay, right? Okay. Dear Seth, for the first year of my life, I was strapped into a chair to help with hip dysplasia. I heard Irene mentioning once that you guys have worked with people with that particular experience. Do you have any specific ideas to work with this old trauma? I feel very stopped from getting out of the house to anything, really. There's always a feeling of like a hurdle, a perceived glass ceiling around achievement, and a general helplessness or lostness, stuckness. Yeah, absolutely. Everything you describe is a common experience from this particular trauma, which we have both worked with. Irene more so. But yeah, anytime one has their legs put in a brace or immobilized in some way during a crucial period of development, it's hugely impactful on the whole being in terms of their sense of what they can do in the world. Because movement development, goes hand in hand with development of our brain and our emotions. You can't fully have one without the other. When we learn to crawl and do this, we're also developing our bilateral nature of our brain, left, right, how these hemispheres work together, how the eyes work together. When we learn to roll over and come to sit and come to stand, all of that goes hand in hand with our sense of self and our achievement of as an organism. Like I am doing what I am designed to do. I am learning to become this being. So when that gets interrupted, even through something that may have been necessary, it has a huge impact, and what you describe is very common. The main remedy, I would say, for working with this type of experience is actually going to come through mostly through Feldenkrais, and through very important trauma-informed Feldenkrais. So there's many Feldenkraisian lessons that will get you into moving and developing in the way that you missed, working with the hips, working with the legs, working with the pelvis, and really the whole system. But the doorway in is likely through the lower body. And that can bring up a lot. So I think it's going to be really helpful to explore some specific Feldenkrais lessons that I'll mention. But please know that you really need to give yourself permission to not override, to really listen as you're doing these Feldenkrais practices. And just what if something comes up, like you're doing something, all of a sudden you're flooded with anger or shame, or you feel grief, leave the Feldenkrais lesson, press pause, and really process what's happening. Process what's available. Are there trauma-informed Feldenkrais directories? Sadly, no. You must bring the trauma-informed lens to this. There are practitioners who are trauma-informed who do Feldenkrais. I don't know, though, of like a directory or a website or anything like that. However, Mara on our team is trained in Feldenkrais and SE. She's a trauma-informed Feldenkrais practitioner. Rebecca also, I believe, she also is both Feldenkrais and SE. They're both on the Smart Body but Smart Mind site in practitioners available for sessions. I don't think there's any more who are trained in Feldenkrais. Oh, that's right, Carrie. That's right. Carrie is trained in Feldenkrais and an SE who's here with us. So there's a bunch of options there for practitioners to work with who will be able to help you guide you through this stuff. Also, you can do it yourself with your own trauma informed awareness, working with the lessons on the site and other places. So specifically, Lab 8, lessons 1 and 2 would be good ones. Lab 9, lesson 1. And Lab 10, lesson 2. Once again, that's Lab 8, lessons 1 and 2. Lab 9, lesson 1. And Lab 10, lesson 2. Those are all Feldenkrais lessons that work with either the hips, legs, or pelvis. Also, in terms of other resources, I do recommend exploring some private sessions with one of our lovely Feldenkrais SE people. But if you also want another resource for audio lessons that are self-guided, there is a Feldenkrais First app that was developed by Andrew and Jeff, two of the highest level Feldenkrais people that I know. So that's on the App Store. It's called Feldenkrais First. And that is a whole database of audio lessons. I imagine you could just search in there for hips, legs, pelvis, see what comes up. And also, Ryan Nagy, that's Ryan, Ryan, Nagy, Nagy. I have his link pulled up, so I'll go ahead and pop that in the chat, Carrie. Here's his website. That is also a big database of recorded Feldenkrais lessons. So lots to explore there. And that really is, I mean, Feldenkrais, he was developing lessons for incredibly deep trauma work, I think, without knowing that he was doing that. Because all of his stuff taps deep into developmental patterns. So when those things got interrupted and you do a Feldenkrais lesson, it can be so powerful. And just, again, know that can be emotionally as well. It may spark up survival energy. It may spark up emotion. If that happens, you just pause and process. And then leave it even for the day. Consider leaving it. Come back tomorrow or the next day. Okay, two more. I'm an alumni. I grew up with alcoholism and a lot of anger and arguments in the home. I've never been abused, but I've discovered that within me there is a deep-rooted fear of experiencing violence. This is manifesting as intrusive violent images and hypervigilance. The fear isn't connected to a specific memory, so I struggle to really work on this. Other than generally building my capacity, how can I work specifically on the fear? So I hear you. It sounds like you were never hit or maybe screamed at, which would be surprising to me if actually you grew up with alcoholism, anger, and arguments. But, you know, just a heads up, if you were yelled at, screamed at, manipulated in any way, told to go buy alcohol for your parents, anything in this realm, that's abuse. Growing up with alcoholic parents who are angry and arguing all the time is also basically abuse. Even if it's not directed at you, that is violence in the home, okay? So that, give yourself permission to understand that, yeah, the reason you have fear of violence and you're having these intrusive violent images is because you grew up immersed in violence. So it completely makes sense. Violence isn't always physical. When you're shouting and screaming at each other, that is violent. So this completely makes sense. You say other than generally building capacity. Well, first off, that's the key to start with. I don't want you to bypass that. When we grew up in this kind of environment, we really do need to build our capacity. So baseline safety, figuring out your capacity, all of this stuff. So the kidney adrenal lessons, watering the brainstem, the containment lessons, the layers lessons, the gut-brain awareness and intention. These are all helpful for sort of building those foundations. There is, again, I'll refer to it. I have the link here, I believe. Within the SBSM, most frequently asked questions. I'll just pop this link in. There's a question that talks about having early developmental trauma and what are the best practices for building capacity, internal safety, etc. So I'm just going to copy that and put it right in here. All right, there it is. And again, of course, remember, with all these links, they'll be on the replay page. You don't have to write them all down or copy them now. They'll be on the replay. So that has the whole list of building capacity lessons. Again, everyone's different. Your system's unique. So some of them will probably work for you. Some of them may not. Just figure out which ones of those really work for you. Because building capacity and baseline safety is the key. Because you need to have the space in your system to work with the violence that you internalized. Now, you ask, other than building capacity, how can I work specifically on the fear? Again, it's about mobilization, allowing it to express through the body. Maybe you need to really act out that fear, let it run through the legs, let it do something else, listen to your impulses. Maybe you need to flip that script. You can flip fear into fight. So maybe that's what you need to do. One way you can do that is by starting to feel the fear and work with it, and you sort of visualize yourself running and maybe even let your legs run a little bit, but then you see yourself stopping and turning and facing the thing that you're afraid of? And what would you need to do to face it? How big would you need to be? How could you get ready to attack? Again, your imagination is limitless. You can grow into a giant. You can shoot laser beams from your eyes. Whatever you need to do, you can be a fire-breathing dragon. You can chop off heads, right? You can do whatever you need to do in your imagination. And just a reminder, all that visualizing works best when it comes along with the fast physical motion, right? So if I am turning into a dragon, I'm gonna bite off my dad's head. Okay, I'm really seeing him, and then I'm gonna bite, and I'm gonna. And I'm gonna really take my time to go slow and see it. And I'm gonna feel the blood squirting down my throat. And I'm gonna see his head rolling on the floor. And it's gonna be violent and gross. This is annihilation work, right? Again, high energy, high capacity work. But essentially, you have violence internalized in yourself. And it needs to come out. And oftentimes, the way it needs to do that is by being redirected to the source. And again, this isn't about hurting anybody. This is about using our imagination and our physicality to channel those impulses in a safe way, in a safe way that where we stay connected to ourselves. Crush your home, destroy it, whatever it is. Find a way to let the energy of this fear find its expression. And again, you may need to build foundations for that to happen effectively. All right, last question. What is the connection between nervous system dysregulation and dopamine addiction? I really struggle with doing all types of chores, starting, completing, following through, which has a negative impact on my health. I recently learned that these problems can be related to dopamine addiction. I wonder how this is related to nervous system dysregulation, since the search for instant gratification overlap between the two. How can SBSM help me with this? Okay. So what is dopamine? Dopamine is the feel-good chemical. It gives us a little rush, makes us feel like we've accomplished something, we've achieved something. It's a pleasurable feeling. It used to be that to get that hit, you would have to successfully hunt and slay a saber-toothed tiger, or find enough berries and roots for your tribe to eat that night. It used to be a lot harder to get those dopamine hits. You get it through a connection with your spouse when you get home. Now you can get a dopamine hit through your phone. Oh boy, how lovely. So this has become a real problem because the reason we want those dopamine hits is because they feel good. And guess what? Trauma doesn't feel good. Survival chemistry doesn't feel good. It's a way of counteracting the chemistry of survival, which is lots of adrenaline and cortisol, feeling on edge. So, of course, oh wow, I can just do this and then I can press this little thing and I feel this little chemical. Salvation, I'm healed, right? Except for this, then we just get stuck in addiction and it goes nowhere, right? Because it is instant gratification. Resolving survival chemistry, resolving trauma is nowhere near instant gratification, I'm sorry to say. It is a long process that takes time and dedication and work. And change is slow a lot of the time. So it's the opposite of instant gratification. So dopamine, getting your little dopamine hit, man, that is yeah, it's just, of course, it's a natural response to living with stuff that feels bad. Unfortunately, it doesn't help us. So, also that need for the dopamine hit can itself become part of the survival strategy. It's like you start to feel you have a survival urge driving the need for the dopamine hit. So then that's why when you take away your kid's tablet or your phone, which unfortunately they may have gotten way too early, then here comes the temper tantrum because that was helping me manage my survival energy. Damn you. And now you've taken it away. So yeah, we got to be really careful with our devices. Thankfully, this is starting to become more known. Kids really should not have anything like this until they've developed, I'd say until a teenager, because they just cannot handle it. They cannot handle that, the ease of that dopamine hit. Even if they're not traumatized, still should not be getting these things. So, how can SPSM help me with this? Well, you have to let go of the, you know, and you don't have to let go of it. You can still get your dopamine hits, but you're going to have to do something else and start to replace that behavior with this work, which again is not a dopamine hit. So, the way that we learn something else and get true lasting satisfaction is by learning to feel all the stuff that doesn't feel good. Again, that is the ultimate point of this work, is that we develop the capacity to finally feel all the really painful stuck shit that we've been holding sometimes for decades and decades. And that's how you actually get a sense of real satisfaction, real accomplishment. Believe me, dopamine hit ain't nothing in comparison to the feeling you get when you realize you just did something completely different than how you used to. And that tends to be how change shows up in this work. It's like, oh, it tends to happen in hindsight a lot of the time. It's like, oh my gosh, I just realized I went through that supermarket store and I actually didn't even once think about how I looked. Or I actually didn't think someone was going to attack me. I felt pretty comfortable. Oh, wow. Or, oh, I just noticed I walked by a mirror without checking my reflection. Cool. Or, wow, I just spoke up. I just spoke my truth to somebody. I didn't even think about it. I just said what I felt. It can happen in all sorts of ways. The ways in which we start to show up and respond differently than our old survival reactions. And that is incredibly gratifying and fulfilling, but it does take time and work. Great question. So, if I'm still finding myself turning to short-term dopamine hits, then am I still in some form of survival response? Most likely, I mean, if you, it's an addiction, right? And all addictions are a way to manage and soothe pain, fundamentally. All addiction, whether it's shopping for records or heroin, it's the addiction is a way to soothe pain, whether no matter what it is. It can sometimes be possible to retain habits. Like, I'm just so used to doing this thing, even though I don't really need to anymore. So that sometimes happens. And then there comes that willpower. It's like, why am I still doing this? I don't even need to do this anymore. And if an addiction has been there for a long time, that can be a period of healing, where you don't really have this underlying survival energy more, but the behavior is just so entrenched, it takes time to rewire. So that is also a possibility. All right. Well, thank you all again for showing up for another call and hanging out. We will again have one more bonus call in a few weeks, I believe. So I look forward to seeing you there. And as you move on, please orient to the fact that SPSM is not over. It actually is never over because you can always access all the material. If this is your first time through, now you're an alumni, you always will have access to all the stuff. And you can keep on moving on through that stuff or repeating stuff as you desire in the few months in between live sessions. So just please remember that you're free to keep on doing all this stuff. Our team will be on the site continuing to moderate and answer questions. For another month as well. So, yeah, you will have lots of support and maybe 2 or 3 months where you're flying solo, and that still means you can keep doing the work. All sorts of options. So, all right. Oh, nice. Happy birthday. Yay. Okay. All right. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next time. Bye for now.